after that, and all we talked about is just
after
the
what?
Signs
you mean,
that
after, what?
After the advent of Imam Mahdi.
But we have been discussing whatever is going to happen. I mean, about the
no, you said that about the uncertain signs.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure about
the, what as it, for uncertain signs. Yeah, there are plenty.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, and we discussed them briefly. Mm. And since we do not have much more of time, we leave the rest of discussion for the other episode. Up until now, thank you for staying with us. This was all for today. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow?
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all listeners of Iran Radio. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Stay with us for the next hour.
Israel is committing a live-stream genocide, yet Israeli sporting teams and players have not been declared global pariahs. They continue to participate in club and international competitions with the full backing of governing bodies. As bodies are bloodied, starved, and martyred in Gaza by the IOF, Israeli teams attempt to whitewash their genocide. Nowhere is this starker than in the world's global sport, football. Calls to FIFA and UEFA, the sports governing bodies, have fallen on deaf ears despite public revulsion at Israeli actions. But Israeli teams may soon be shown the red card. A brand new initiative aims to target those at the very heart of football and bring about a revolution through sports. Leading the campaign is Ashish Prashar. He is a former Middle East Peace Envoy Advisor, political strategist and speaker. Thank you very much, Ashish, for joining us today to speak about this. Why football? You know, why are you trying to address the genocide through sports and specifically through football?
Well, there's a saying that there should be no normalization in abnormal times. And what is more normal than people playing football, right? We think about how that brings people together culturally, through, you know, fans, through games, through moments in life. And it's really important that if a state is committing a genocide, that it has no place in that. You know, the if you look at the big impact from the South African apartheid timeline, the sports boycott had a pivotal impact on them dismantling the apartheid regime. And it's because it was isolation. But also, moreover, sport connects with everybody. Unlike any other cultural thing like art or music, pretty much everybody engages in what they would call the Colosseum in every way, right? Mm-hmm. And no other sport is bigger than football. Yeah. And with football, you trigger all the other sports, right? You know, if football goes, the Olympics go. If football goes, all the other sports mm-hmm. follow. And that isolates this genocidal entity. And that's why it's so important that we follow this path.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, amazing to see how different countries, different cultures, you know, when we talk of the big football clubs, how, you know, there's such attachment in different mm-hmm. parts of the world. Ashish, tell us about the initiative itself. You know, what is it about and what are you trying to really achieve?
Well, look, you said it yourself in the opening. FIFA mm-hmm. and UEFA have ignored calls to throw Israel out of football for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it even goes longer. You know, Israel's been sports washing their crimes mm-hmm. Through sport mm-hmm. and culture for decades, right? Campaigns have been running for mm-hmm. decades to kick them out of football. They failed. I mean, they've raised awareness, but the reality is you have an immoral being at the top of FIFA who's best friends with Donald Trump right now. Mm-hmm. The idea that he is individually going to throw Israel out, I think, is a non-starter. So we have to think of different, more radical tactics, mm-hmm. right? And there's a saying in the Black Panthers, like, use some radical imagination. We know we can't get the top. Israel's also invested heavily in protecting their place at FIFA's table. So where do we go? We follow something that just happened in recent history. When Russia was thrown out of football, they weren't thrown out because FIFA and UEFA have morals. In fact, the only consistent thing here is the head of FIFA has no morals and he doesn't care if white children or brown children are being killed. He kicked them out because on the second day of the invasion, 12 European countries led by Sweden and Poland boycotted Russia. They wouldn't play the Russian national team. They wouldn't play their club teams. And for that reason, they forced UEFA and FIFA to suspend Russia because football couldn't continue. It actually impacted the integrity of the game. Mm-hmm. And we are following that same model. We are starting a coordinated campaign to target European football federations and, moreover, the heads of European football federations. So we are asking the public to flood those football federations, protest them daily, protest the chief execs and presidents of those. Because here's the other kicker. Most chief execs and presidents of football federations have executive power, meaning they can actually just boycott a nation, club, or a player if they deem it's the right decision. So that's individuals really, yeah, have this power, yeah. And I want to make that really clear.
Yeah.
You can target someone who is an accessible yeah. person in your country and demand they take action to get these genocidal players out of your country, get that genocidal team never step foot on your pitch, and make sure that genocidal state is not normalized anymore in your country. So you should be going out there to demand your federation acts.
Which is quite surprising, I mean, at least for me, you know, countries, for example, like Spain, where we've seen a lot of pro-Palestinian, you know, movements and things happening, yet we haven't seen anything from football. I mean, does it surprise you?
I mean, it doesn't, right? There's a lot of money in football, and I'm sure that's played a massive role in this, and I'm sure there's lots of pressure coming down from FIFA on federations not to do anything. But also, I think actually the bigger reason is nobody knows they can do this. Okay. You know, how many people actually knew that there was a boycott of Russia before the FIFA suspension? These federation heads, including in nations like Ireland, Norway, and Spain, who are supposedly Palestinian allies, they get away with the fact that nobody knows they can do this. Most football fans don't know they can do this. Most footballers don't know they can do this. I've talked to many people in the football space who didn't realize that that's what caused the suspension in Russia. Mm-hmm. And these people are experts. And they were like, oh, I didn't realize that. And that is the most powerful thing here. Now, we are tired of protesting and nobody listening, right? Gianni Infantino is the same as Trump or Starmer. He's sitting in neon Switzerland, doesn't care that we sit in stands. Mm-hmm. In fact, he even made a point of moving his North American headquarters to Trump Tower. If you ever wanted a sign that he doesn't care about our protests, he stuck his flag in the ground and said, this is where I stand. So what do? We go after accessible targets, people in our countries that actually might have said they care about Palestinians in some cases, especially at a government level. In societal level, I think everyone in Europe we targeted is on our side. We are the people, and we have actual power here to make sure that they know that we will not let it be unknown that they've been sports washing genocide this entire time. So as we launch this campaign, everyone's name will be public who has this power in each football federation. And like I said, we demand that they act to boycott Israel, because there's no way this genocidal entity who now it's been declared by the UN that it is a genocide, should continue to participate on the pitches of Europe.
So apart from fans, which I believe are the ones you're targeting, you know, who else are you mobilizing? And how would you suggest people support the campaign?
People of conscience. This is not a, like, hey, you have to be a football fan. By the way, I think everybody, in a weird way, is, it's like I said, it's the only global game, right? Everybody kind of watches it to a degree. But it's people of conscience. Like, I don't really believe that there's any difference between a football fan, a union member, a political strategist or whatever, right? This is an opportunity to actually knock one of the core pillars out from the Israeli regime. This is an opportunity to knock the culture pillar out. And then the economic pillar falls too. Isolation causes more isolation, right? If we keep going down this path, we knock this one. By the way, this is an easy win. If we sustain pressure on these football federation heads, everywhere they go, not just at the federation building, their homes, their schools, this is important because they, at this point, are complicit. The heads of federations in Italy, France, Spain, Ireland are complicit because they have known for the last 2 years they can act. And if they claim solidarity with Palestine, they've done nothing to show it. Norway recently said they will play the game with Israel and donate the funds to Gaza. I mean, yes, Norway, an allied nation, and their head of the federation wears a kefir, but she knows deep down she can boycott Israel. Like, and the reason we're doing this simultaneously here, because I want to be a realist about this, because, yes, I've said that about Norway, but Norway are not going to give up their World Cup place, right? But the reason we're doing it across Europe at the same time is so they provide each other cover. Yeah. So you did this once as 12 nations. Do it again as 12 nations, or 9 nations, or 8 nations, or however many of you decide to do it together. Because I guarantee you, UEFA and FIFA are not going to punish all of you as a collective. Could you imagine an environment where they throw Spain, the number one team in football, out of a World Cup for Israel?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the collective part of it, I think, is the most effective, you know, strategy. But what would you suggest, you know, people who are listening probably and thinking, you know, I want to support this initiative. How do they put pressure? What do they do?
Obviously, the easy tools to use are emailing the federation heads. Calling the federation offices, making sure your demands are met. But organize, organize, organize. They are scared of you. There's a French saying, nous sommes le pouvoir, we are the power. Came out of the 70s and the 60s when the unions took control of the countries. You are powerful beyond measure. And we need to organize things every day. Don't just rely on football fans and the ultras that have been organizing the first wave of protests. Palestinian movements should be targeting them. This is a win. We're always saying, how can we win? What are we going to do to make a change immediately, right? They can make this decision tomorrow. Yeah. They don't need to vote. They don't need to consult. They don't need to do anything. Apply pressure every day till they break. And Israel will not be playing those international games in October against Italy and Norway. Israeli club teams will not play in European competitions, and Israeli players will be banned from stepping foot in Europe. But it only works if you apply pressure. They are scared of you, and they know you mobilized. You mobilize at a target that is accessible. Not prime ministers and presidents sit behind gates that don't care that what we say on the street when we protest on a Saturday, they're not even there. Be there. Every time fans get together for a game, they're already mobilized.
Yeah.
So now direct that anger to them and then go to the game.
Yeah.
And if they end up at the game, protest them at the game. These federation heads travel to games.
Amazing. And I mean, honestly, it's a no-brainer in a way. I mean, it's not just that there is a genocide going on. They're specifically targeting, you know, sporting facilities. 800 athletes in Gaza have been killed, have been murdered, you know. Why has it taken so long, Ashish? Why has this mobilization not happened earlier? Why are people not aware of these things?
Lack of radical imagination in some cases, I think. I think there's a twofold answer to that. I think you want to believe that there is moral. At some stage, something will kick in with individuals that they've seen enough, they've got to do something. But you have to look at the leadership of the West right now, and our governing bodies in sport are a reflection of that leadership. They're soulless. Like, they don't care about the value of our life, right? So if that is the top, we've got to be radical of how we use different tools and techniques and targets to get what we want to be delivered here, which is ending this genocide, right? And I think sometimes certain organizations move like oil tankers, and they're stuck on the path of a campaign that they believe in, But unfortunately, that campaign is never going to work by itself. So we're taking it one step further. Mm. I believe in that original campaign. Mm. But hey, it's not working. So now what else can we do? We take it one step further. That original campaign mobilized fans, got them to care about Palestine. But guess what? Now let's deploy the fans in a strategic way, in an actual strategic way, to actually get Israel booted out of football, get them boycotted by every European nation.
Do you think there's enough of the fans and, you know, the public in Europe to support this?
Yes. We don't need new people to join this movement. They're already there. You've watched us march in our millions. Right, and you watch football fans chant in their tens of thousands of stadiums. In fact, Paris Saint-Germain's fans, who I'm going to call out directly, started the chant about, you know, Nous l'enfant de Gaza. We are the kids of Gaza. We are the children of Gaza. Right, they've led that chant, and people sing it all over Europe. You know, and I think this shows you there's a deep connection, a deep solidarity with regular people. I think the problem with our movement so much is we obviously rely on celebrity to amplify something, right? And this is the case with many movements. Malcolm X always used to say that, you know, celebrities are puppets and can be controlled opposition. The actual power to make this happen isn't Mohamed Salah, isn't another famous footballer. The power to make this happen, what they're really scared of, is the people. And if the people are there every day outside that federation will buckle and break.
And when it comes to football, I mean, you can't overestimate, you know, the power of the fans who actually make football clubs what they are. Mm-hmm. Who else, Ashish, is involved in this campaign? You know, organizations, people behind it?
And people behind it, you know, there's amazing human beings behind this who've given up their time to work on this. Mm-hmm. But organizations, like we have the ADC in the United States, the Hind Rajab Foundation, you know, we have Code Pink. People who know how to organize, by the way. People who are doing radical things, like chasing, you know, IOF soldiers around the world. Shout out to the Hind Rajab Foundation. That is radical work. You know, we're not going to wait for an end of a genocide. We're going to do it while it's happening. We wanted to put a group together who actually have radical imagination and want to chase an end goal and actually deliver something. You know, the problem with some of our institutions in this space, they were built for a timeline that was slower, right? They were built on the models of apartheid South Africa. I believe in BDS, but the reality with that, it was built in an environment where white South Africans were not exterminating the black population because they needed them as a labor force. Yep. The difference here is the Israeli occupation wants to exterminate every last Palestinian, and they're doing it at the quickest rate that they've done since the beginning of the genocide right now, because they've got it on multiple fronts, the starvation, the bombing, everything. They are killing people en masse, but we're operating like an oil tanker to stop it. So we need to be more radical, faster. The flotilla is a great example. Yeah. That is commitment to change, you know.
Yeah.
People trying to do all sorts of different things in Europe, like challenging embassies and ambassadors at this point. So why are they not doing something? That is radical attacks. We need to keep going down that line. We need to put pressure on individuals who have power to change things, right? We have the ability to change this. We need to shut down cities.
Yes.
Look at the French. Only last week they had a general strike. They're having another general strike this week, shutting down economies.
Yeah.
If we really want to do this, we need to be more radical. No more playing the long game, because there will be no one left to play the long game for.
Absolutely.
And the reality with this, this can work tomorrow. If we did this for 3 or 4 days this week, these federations will bend and break. And the ones who are Palestinian allies have no reason not to say they're not going to boycott. Calling out Norway here, calling out Ireland, calling out Belgium's now new government who's saying they support Palestine, calling out Portugal, Spain, Italy, who are the public, have been mass mobilized on behalf of Palestine, where unions are threatening national strikes. They are speaking for Palestine as we speak, and they will deliver justice. So those guys, take all those protests and anger at your federation, because they will break, because the public is on your side.
Some people might say to you, you know, you should not mix politics with sports. What would you say?
Muhammad Ali. Sport speaks to the people. There's nothing else to say. Mm-hmm. What, anyone not speaking out about the genocide in sport is a coward. You know, there's a lot of silence in sport. And it's, how are you not a human being? Also, what athletes don't realize and what they need to start realizing, especially in sports like football, is you're more powerful than the organization. Mm-hmm. They need you. It is a disgrace that some of the most high-powered footballers in the world, who control millions in endorsements and everything else, they're not going to take that from you. They need you. Mohamed Salah is a great example. The Premier League going to sanction him because he speaks on behalf of Palestine? Not a chance in hell. They use him to market to the entire continent of Africa. Like, they need him more than he needs them.
Yeah. And this is all about humanity. You can't separate these different aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, politicians have been involved in sports. You talked of, the South African example. There wasn't the kind of lobby that Israeli, so the Zionist control. So this is not, you know, these are not separate components. These are all parts of what makes our lives.
Look, anytime there's war crimes, mass atrocities, genocide, you have to look at everything, right? It's not just about military and politics. Mm. Culture normalizes evil entities with us. And culture is where they should not be welcome as well. Because you isolate them. They are a pariah. You have to isolate them. Sport is part of life. You have to ask why people divide everything. Why do they categorize everything? They do that so it's harder to actually change anything. In the end of the day, whether you're a footballer or a politician, you're a human being. Whether you're a fan or a union member, you're a human being. And if you care about other human beings, you should be acting right now. Right?
So this... Obviously, this is all about stopping the genocide, you know, and it's about Palestinians. But do you think this could be a crack for bigger things if we were able to succeed with this? Because there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of power, like you say, controlled in football. But if this cracks, that there'll be bigger repercussion than just stopping the genocide.
I mean, my focus on this campaign is the genocide. Mm. And the goal is to make Israel... the Israeli occupation as isolated as possible to stop any form of normalization. Like I said to you at the beginning, football is the first domino. The Olympics will go. Other cultural institutions will go. Eurovision is going as we speak. Art will go. Other things will go. If football goes, the cultural dominoes are huge. It's why you always go after what they invest in. You don't go after something they don't care about. The reason they invest so heavily in football is they know the domino effect. And we need to go after that with everything we have because we know it will topple a lot of other things. And if we do that, they will be isolated beyond measure. And then it starts to affect the economy. Mm. My only goal here is to stop the genocide, like anybody else I know who's working on anything right now related to Palestine. And if this puts a nail in the Israeli occupation's coffin, that's great.
What would determine, you know, the success of the campaign? And what's the timeline you're looking at?
We want them to act as soon as possible. Mm. There is no timeline. The goal is to have them kicked out tomorrow, yesterday, right? The success here is as many European nations as possible boycott the Israeli occupation's national team, their club teams, and ban their players from ever stepping foot in Europe again. And the goal is to have as many European nations do that. And we believe we can get half a dozen to 10 to go in the first couple of weeks, but it requires the people, because the people are the power. And when we start recognizing that, stop relying on celebritification or, you know, big social media accounts to do the work for us, we'll realize that we can change anything we want.
Thank you so much, Ashish. It's amazing that you are, you know, working on this campaign. And I'm sure, you know, everybody will support it. We, of course, will continue to monitor and spotlight this important initiative. Thank you all so much for being with us on this special program. And once again, thank you again, Ashish, for both doing the initiative and for sitting down with us to speak about this. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Almost 2 years later, and after at least 65,000 people have been slaughtered, with many saying that number may be as high as 250,000 fatalities, the United Nations is finally calling the Israeli terror campaign in Gaza a genocide. Why now? Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister says Israel is facing increasing pressure internationally and that the regime must rely on itself. Stay with us as we take a look at the swing of the pendulum away from the Zionist regime and what that may mean on this spotlight.
An unprecedented form of diplomatic pressure, legal action, and economic measures is isolating the Israeli regime on the world stage, with Prime Minister Netanyahu now acknowledging the crisis.
A media siege funded by massive amounts of money from Qatar and other countries like China. They are operating in the West, and no less so in the United States. The second part is more focused, and it is centered in Western European countries, through the activation of Muslim minorities there, who are becoming vocal, violent, and threatening the states. That's why we see this siege concentrating in Western Europe. As I said, arms shipments to us are being halted. This is happening now.
Netanyahu framed it as a necessity. But opposition leader Yair Lapid blasted the comments as a direct result of Netanyahu's flawed and failed policy. The pressure intensified dramatically with a report from United Nations investigators. They concluded Israel has perpetrated genocide in Gaza, deliberately targeting civilians.
The commission finds it is genocide. In our report, the commission found that the Israeli authorities and Israeli security forces committed and are continuing to commit the following underlying acts of genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
The report implicates senior officials, including Netanyahu and others, for inciting genocidal acts. The findings have been submitted to the International Criminal Court. Global response to Israeli crimes is escalating. Countries like the UK, France, and Canada to formally recognize a Palestinian state. Belgium has banned imports from illegal settlements. Spain has imposed a partial arms ban. And Persian Gulf states are urging a reconsideration of ties with Israel. Israel relies heavily on the unwavering support from the United States, which protects it from severe repercussions. However, this support contrasts with a genocide that has no clear end game or tangible results beyond devastation. Hamas remains undefeated, and there is no political solution to the Gaza war. So, where is Israel going? The regime is at a crossroads facing unprecedented global condemnation and stuck in a costly war with no viable exit strategy. The pressing question is no longer just about military victory, but about how Israel navigates its rapidly diminishing standing in the world and what kind of future it can secure for itself.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Out of Beirut, author and researcher Daniel Yekic. And out of London, activist and political analyst Batu Sobeti. Well, thanks so much for being with us. Let me start this off with Daniel. I mean, the indiscriminate bombings, killings, and targeting of infrastructure by Israel was actually initiated from the very beginning of its onslaught on Gaza. So what happened? What is different right now that the UN decided to now call this a genocide?
That's a very good question, because even if we look at the confirmation by the UN today that the Israeli violence and crimes against humanity in fact constitute a genocide, even this is too little too late. It is, of course, good that there is this acknowledgement and documented. But Palestinians, Palestinian voices and sources that are generally marginalized, not only in the public discourse, but in the international community as such, have been documenting the genocide for so long before October 7, because the entire colonial project as such is a genocidal. What has changed today, if we look at the development in the last 23 months since October 7, is that the global pressure against the Israeli regime is unprecedented, and it is impossible to ignore the human rights violations and the ongoing genocide, given the global pressure, given the protests among average citizens around the world in major cities, including in Western cities, and as a result, the pressure on Western governments for their complicity on the one hand, and of course, their lack of action, and of course, a general frustration with the international institutions, the international community, and in particular, of course, also the UN and its institutions, which have shown a severe failure to intervene in this ongoing genocide. So even this acknowledgement today that there is a genocide is stating very much the obvious after at least 2 years of the Israeli regime live streaming its genocide and frankly bragging about it, if we look at the political communication from that regime. So on the one hand, it is unprecedented that we see this global calling out of the Israeli regime, but again, given the imbalance of power structures worldwide, it is still too little too late. And the other question, of course, what can be done as a consequence to intervene and to help Palestinians who continue to be massacred as we speak this very moment?
Right. Well, staying with you, Daniel, I mean, you just mentioned about the global awareness. So how big of a part has that played in it all? And what does that mean? Does it mean that the UN, if there was not this increased pressure, and there has been from the global community for a while now, that basically they would continue to ignore this? Because at the same time, as we've been saying, it still has taken 2 years to happen.
Exactly. And I think one of the reasons is, of course, the pressure among regular citizens, among activists, also to some, to a smaller extent, some media, even among the powerful global media that has shed light to some extent, again, but still in a very biased way, oftentimes against Palestinians, and the complicity, I think, of the international community, because what has happened in the past 2 years is that the Israeli regime has created a lawless world that we live in, where it stands above the law, it stands outside of international law, which puts into question the very existence of the UN, the existence of international law, if there are no mechanisms that can enforce any consequences or sanctions against regimes that commit genocide. So obviously, whatever is happening in Gaza today is something that can also expand and happen elsewhere, because that's the damage that Israeli regime has done to humanity. But even within the UN, if we look at the political communication, oftentimes we still hear the very powerful dominant rhetoric about the so-called two-state solution, about the so-called diplomatic recognition, and oftentimes viewing the situation in Palestine as if it were a conflict, quote-unquote, between two countries and not a genocide. So I think what is very important here is that the language has changed, that less euphemism and sugarcoating is used to actually refer and to state the obvious, which is a genocide, and which affects, of course, also humanity beyond Palestine.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Batul, do you think that it would have taken the UN 2 years to declare this a genocide if, for example, this was happening in Ukraine and Russia was the culprit? Okay, unfortunately, it seems that we have some difficulties establishing that line. I'm going to throw that back to you, Daniel. Your thoughts on that same question. Would it be the same if this was happening, what we've been witnessing now for 2 years, this genocide in Gaza, if it was happening in Ukraine and Russia was the culprit, would it take the UN 2 years to determine that this is a genocide? I mean, how do you see it?
Of course not. Obviously, because of the Western interest, if we look at, as you pointed out, I mean, Ukraine, that's another war that has been receiving a lot of media and political attention in the last 2 years, which is a proxy war that is being fought by NATO and by the European Union on behalf of their weapons industry and their economic interests, where sometimes the political focus and the rhetoric is focusing on the Ukrainians, but very much Ukraine is being abused by the West in this case for its own goals. And Russia, of course, in this case, is which is identified as the aggressor, is a major or considered a threat to some extent by Europe, by other Western powers. And so given those power relations and the intentions towards Russia from the West, which are in this case to contain Russia, to decrease its power and influence, would have obviously led to a very different framing. I think we even see that the situation in Ukraine is even sometimes compared to Palestine, which of course, I mean, it is horrible, any war in which civilians are killed. But even here, there is an entire history of a century of genocidal colonialism in Palestine that is still being very much upheld by the West. So I think the power imbalance and, of course, the centrality of the military-industrial complex of NATO and, of course, the Western world very much shapes the way in which wars are framed. We can even look at throughout the region of Western Asia. Syria is another example where the West.
Stay with me, Daniel. Sorry to interrupt you, but hopefully we've established that connection with Batul now. Thanks so much, Batul, for being with us, and sorry about the technical issues. I mean, your thoughts. What does it mean now that the UN has declared this a genocide? So what? Now, what's going to happen? Which measures can this organization now take against the Israeli regime?
Right. Thanks for having me, Marzia. The UN, as we know, since its inception, its resolutions don't get enacted. So, for example, the resolution that, you know, the Palestinians have the right to return, or the annexation of the West Bank and the occupation in Gaza in 1967 is illegal. At the end of the day, this is more of a moral declaration, but practically speaking on the ground, it means nothing, because we know the decisions of the UN means nothing. Why? Because the UN as an institution was created post-World War II by the victors of the war, which was chiefly America at the time. So there's really no means or mechanisms of implementation when it comes to the UN, because we know that these decisions also, all these resolutions that come out, are not a part of the Security Council where it's like binding. But what it is you've got the majority of the countries now recognize this to be a reality, with pressure from the majority of the public, which has turned into this general perception, which they have no choice but to acknowledge. But we know that it's the West that ultimately controls the UN when it comes to decision-making, because the UN is driven by America more than anything else. Ultimately, we have reached this level because of the accumulation. It's reached a boiling point. The situation has become unbearable and exposed to a level that is unacceptable by any degree. And once it reaches this stage, the UN has to take some kind of stance. Some things can be withstood, others can't. But when they want to finish Gaza in front of the bare eyes of the world, and they've reached this level of not caring about anything, the entity is completely unleashed and untamed, which, may I add, is a point of complete weakness and not strength for Israel to act like this. For it to break all international resolutions and agreements and to hit and strike whenever and whatever, Israel considers that it's able to do this because it's going through an existential crisis. For that reason, it considers that it has a free hand to break every law because there's something much bigger at stake, and that's its very existence. And as a result, we see the complete destruction of Gaza, South Lebanon. We see it going after any entity that it considers a danger in any country, whether it's Qatar or elsewhere. But the strong entity, if Israel was strong, it wouldn't have had to resort to such measures. And this real crisis is that if it remains in its current state, Israel will come to an end. And Israel knows this. And as a result, Israel has two choices in front of it. Either it expands by all means, or if it doesn't resort to expansionism, which it's trying, it will ultimately shrink. And it will end, because if it's not able to expand in a way that guarantees its existence. So for this reason, we see that Israel uses all means to establish itself, but the reality on the ground indicates that only in Syria has it really managed to actually gain some occupation, because there was really no resistance, but it's been really failures in all other fronts.
Well, staying with you, Batul, with what you've just mentioned about Israel feels that it's an existential situation that it has. So now that Netanyahu, now he said that basically the world is against them, they're isolated, and they have to depend on themselves. So let's break this down and exactly what that means and what he is trying to say to the world. It almost seems that, well, could it be that this is actually a threat and just saying where they're going to go from here? And not really that they cared before what various organizations or countries would say, but now saying we're going to do it all ourselves and basically we don't care what anyone says or what anyone tries to do. I mean, your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that is Israel's modus operandi, except it's really showing itself right now, and it's really exposed because of the level of existentialism that it is going through, which means it's so careless and will do anything to the point where it doesn't care what Trump or any other entity for that matter even has to tell it. It's like, we either do what we need to do or we'll die, basically. That's the way that it sees it. So all transgressions against all agreements is an indication of the extent of the weakness and not the strength, because Israel is faced with two choices. Either it expands or it shrinks. And Israel is exposed to the point where it cannot continue, because it strives to achieve whatever result it wants. But such results that it wants, it's not achieving on the ground. And the more Israel transgresses, the more it is becoming exposed in its nature. But we know that Israel breathes through the West, and one of the biggest weaknesses of Israel is that it's so dependent on the external. But when it reaches the point where we see in America and all other nature and in all other nations, it's so exposed, and the roots of its existence has now come into question by the people. It's like, how much more time does it need for this generation, the majority of which believe in the West, that Israel has no right to exist and see the ugliness of this entity? By continuity, these lobbies that exist in the West will not continue, because the people are moving. We see those movements in countries like Spain, in Ireland. Even in European meetings today, they're speaking about sanctions, or even just the fact that they're speaking in the direction of acknowledging the Palestinian statehood gives an indication that these countries consider that they have to take into account public opinion. And this can be developed to the point where Israel becomes a pariah on all fronts. And Herzog himself, the Israeli president, came out and said, you know, this is a serious threat for us. Of course, for someone like Netanyahu to make that declaration, at the end of the day, Netanyahu only wants to save his own existence. He's not really thinking what is in the best interests of Israel, which is why someone like the former PM Olmert would come out and say, actually, Israel's committing war crimes. He's saying Israel's committing war crimes because he recognizes that really it is the real end of Israel that the world recognizes it as a pariah, and we cannot go in that direction. But for someone like Netanyahu, he's not really thinking what is in the best interests of the Israeli occupation entity, because the war in Lebanon, the expanded war in Lebanon, the continued war in Gaza going on for 2 years, none of that is really in the interests of Israel. As a society, we know that it is riddled with contradictions. You know, it's enough to see, especially during the war in Iran, the extent of the Israelis that fled from the country. You had over 30,000 Israelis that were just urgently trying to get off on boats off to Cyprus illegally as a result of that. And just the Israelis feel unsafe as a society as a whole.
Well, let me look at that, Daniel, with the Israelis feeling unsafe. I mean, it has been behaving already like a rabid dog. But, I mean, do you think that basically we're just going to see it become even more extreme because it feels that it has no choice?
Definitely, because the Israeli regime, the entity as such, is built on this very existential contradiction, where on the one hand, it can only exist through perpetual violence because it is an artificially implanted settler colony that is inhabited by settlers who came from other parts of the world to live on stolen Palestinian land, on Palestinian mass graves in Palestinian houses. And so one of the failures in the entire Israeli colonial project is the lack of the settlers' connection to the land. And as the other speaker mentioned, if we just look at the reactions on when Iran defended itself against the U.S.-Israeli attack against Iran, how many settlers were fleeing Palestine? And they were fleeing because either they have a second citizenship, they have somewhere else to go, because they are not from Palestine. So this is one of the major weaknesses here. This is a colony that is trying to exterminate at the same time people who live on their land and who are fighting for their survival, which is also why, if we have to have a comparison here, we can very much say that, you know, Palestinians, Lebanese, anyone in the region who stands in the way of this genocidal settler colonial conquest is fighting for their survival on their own land while the Israeli regime is spreading death and destruction. And in order for it to survive, it needs to spread more death and destruction, again with apartheid and ethnic cleansing being systematic components of this regime, which is now of course completely out of control, stands above international law for the entire world to see. And the consequence of this is for settlers, of course, to feel less safe. And why should a settler feel safe when they are occupying someone else's land and trying to exterminate that population? So a lot of, I think, the decline of the Israeli regime and of the settler society also happens from within. And another reminder of how grave that internal situation within the colony is of course the military censorship. We remember again the Iranian response to the Israeli attacks and how settlers were not allowed to use social media or to post pictures or videos of the damage that has been a consequence of the Iranian response, because and I would like to cite again Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who said at the liberation of Lebanon that the entity is weaker than a spider's web. I think that moment is becoming much more transparent as all of this aggression reaches a culmination, but also shows the very how fragile this artificial genocidal entity really is.
Right. Well, Batul, I mean, we've seen, as you mentioned, that more and more countries are actually saying that they support a Palestinian state. We're seeing on an international level also more support for Palestine and anti-Israeli sentiment. But at the same time, the genocide continues. Palestinians are still being killed and bombed. So do you think that this basically gives an example or sets for the Palestinians that basically there's nothing else that they can do but resist, because not the international so-called community or organizations nor negotiations, at the end of the day, the resistance has to be or is the only way that it can go forward and basically bring this to an end? I mean, how do you see it?
Yes, all of these tools that we've mentioned, and these means, the UN and what branches of the UN, the international courts, they're all very weak. All the organizations that belong to the UN, in actual retrospect, belong to the American and the Western decision. And it is hinged on America that this war is continuing, because it's America that's giving Israel the complete a free hand. So it's unexpected for us to have any expectation for results that will come out of it. Yes, Palestinians for a long time have reached this very conclusion that you are mentioning, and that is that resistance is the only way. Until now, we see it stands as a miracle that Palestinians are resisting, are not complaining about the resistance. The Palestinians in the West Bank understand that resistance is the only means. The Gazawis, we never hear them blame the resistance. We never hear them talk about even October the 7th in a way in which, why did this come upon us? No nation in the world has been tested under such brutal circumstances as the Palestinians in Gaza, and it continues to resist. And that is the cornerstone in which all other actions are built on. Resistance is the cornerstone. Everything else becomes an add-on, but that's the foundation, yes.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Daniel Yekic, author and researcher out of Beirut, Beitou Sobeiti, activist and political analyst out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawafi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim.